It's simple. It's dumb. It's the podcast. To another slightly delayed episode of the podcast. Today's guest, who's here to give his thoughts on the music of Jason Lytle and Granddaddy, is a bit of a surprise, at least it was for me. It was someone who was closely following the Twitter project, where I was ranking all of Jason's songs over the course of a few months, and I remember being shocked at the end when he commented about how much he had enjoyed the project. Today's guest is Drew Brown from the band One Republic. Drew Brown is a guitarist, really a multi-instrumentalist, in the extremely popular band One Republic. In this interview, it's easy to see just how much of a fan of Granddaddy's and Jason's work overall that Drew really is. We'll touch upon a variety of topics, from how Granddaddy never truly became well-known to the wider world, or how easy it is for Drew to relate to Jason's feelings on the music industry. Here's my conversation with Drew Brown from One Republic. Okay, so have you gotten to hear an episode yet, by chance, at all?
Man, yeah, I listened to the first two episodes, and I felt like I have, they made me feel like I have, like I'm very fortunate and have no business being on this podcast. it's such an honor to be asked. Especially, you know, following the first two, where like they actually have a place to stand on to comment on Jason's creativity, and I feel like whatever I could bring to the table would be very, very much more theoretical.
Well, I wanted to kind of get, yeah, and that's great though, I think. I wanted to get different perspectives and not have it just be people that he's worked with and collaborated with. And so, yeah, I thought it would be, yeah. And to be honest, I sent out feelers to like five or six people when the Twitter project ended, and everybody, including yourself, responded back so enthusiastically that I was just like, well, shit, now I got to do it, you know, like,
oh man,
well, no turning back.
Without ruining any of my limited commentary, I haven't really met a Fairweather Granddaddy fan. If you meet somebody and they're like, oh yeah, Granddaddy, they're pretty good, like they're all right, that it's the ultimate That is a cop out answer. That is somebody covering their bases that is not familiar.
Yeah, I have to agree. In fact, in preparing for this episode, I went back and I was kind of researching yourself and kind of any connections with Granddaddy, and I found this one tweet that you made several years ago that had this thinly veiled reference to the EP excerpts from the Diary of Toddzilla. And I was just like, okay, this guy is definitely a Granddaddy fan. This is not a casual, you know, I like Software Slump kind of thing, you know?
So. If that's my pedigree, then then that's something I could be proud of.
So what do you remember about the first time that you heard Granddaddy? Can you share with us what you can recall?
I remember the first time I heard Granddaddy was actually, and this could be sacrilege. It was years before I became what I would consider like a bona fide fan. And I think for a lot of, I chalk that mostly up to age and circumstance. I think that if I were a little bit older, or maybe like a little bit less grounded, like not like in the theoretical sense, but like literally grounded by my parents, then I probably would have had more of an opportunity to be a more active Granddaddy fan. But it was probably, I think it was probably 1999. It was 99 or 2000. And I remember it was AM180. I had a, like, my really good friend had a girlfriend at the time who was really cool and like 3 or 4 years older than us. And we were, you know, we were kind of in the throes of our very run of the mill American teenager, like, you know, listening to Nine Inch Nails and Radiohead and also really, you know, the really great stuff that our parents turned us on to. But we were a couple years away from really branching out into like college radio world. And so the first thing that I heard was AM180, and it was, I remember kind of being blown away by it, because at the time we were just, you know, getting into, you know, kind of indie rock that brought like some of the our favorite like synth elements into crunchy guitars and that whole world. You know, there were some bands that we were really into that were kind of finding an interesting balance of incorporating all of that stuff. But I sadly missed all of the times that Granddaddy came through Colorado. And that was, I remembered that song. And it wasn't until years later when I moved in with my best friend, who was a diehard Granddaddy fan. And he kind of took me under his wing and started me down the path of being a diehard Jason fan.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm sure you're familiar with the Granddaddy story and, you know, their rise to success and then also how they probably broke up a little bit too early by most fans' accounts. But so while they definitely enjoyed some high levels of success, you know, these amazing albums that were loved by fans and critics and even their peers, you know, they played the Glastonbury Festival in 2003. They were on the Letterman Show. Still, despite all of these things, they never seemed to quite reach the level of this widespread, sustained success that many thought they were on track for. You know, the whole American Radiohead,
yeah,
kind of name that they were probably unfairly that was placed upon them. I tried to make sense of this over the years, but it's still kind of unexplainable to me. Do you have any thoughts as to why maybe things just didn't break quite right for them during those early 2000 years as they were, you know, working on the heels of Someday?
You know what? It's funny because I kind of pull apart that weird transitional couple years a lot, trying to make sense of who benefited the most from the sort of shift away from a conventional music business system into the Napster era, and then into the, you know, whatever kind of streaming focused short attention span world we're currently in that followed that. And I think that, because I've thought about this too, when I try to make sense of how this band that I love so much and that everybody I know who has listened to loves so much, like how mm-hmm. it just kind of remained not a complete secret, but a relative secret in the wider world. And I think that there was, I would say that at their peak output, which I, if you want to, you know, like that's a totally different discussion as to, you know, everybody's opinion of what a band's apex would be. But mm-hmm. I think that there was a certain kind of strange anonymity that came along with file sharing and the breakdown of the, you know, traditional music system, that you didn't really have, you know, you weren't getting your music necessarily from the guy at the record store's recommendations or what you were reading in like a music magazine, or the way that you were a few years before Napster. Yep. And you weren't necessarily getting bombarded with these artists that are, you know, you're gonna hear or see them first on social media, like seemingly fully formed. Like it was kind of this in-between zone where you might have a record that a friend burned for you on a CD that just kind of is as strong as the music is, but doesn't necessarily have a very obvious story behind it. So I think that kind of no man's land of being in between two different worlds of how something worked for 20 or 30 years and where we're at now, where it's kind of anybody's, you know, anybody's guess as to how to spread the word on music. I think it helped in a lot of ways, and I think it kind of hurt in a, you know, some artists that you might absolutely love an album, like most of us loved, you know, Someday at Software Slump when they came out, but you might not know really anything about the people that made it. I don't think I found out that Jason was a skateboarder until, I don't know, maybe like 2005 or something. And then, but it made all the sense in the world. Like somebody offhanded, or like somebody made an offhanded comment about him being a professional skateboarder. And I thought, well, of course, like that makes all the sense in the world. All of the most creative people that I know are skateboarders. There's a correlation there. So I think that could be that kind of weird, that had the entire timeline been moved forward or backwards a couple years, I think that it could have been a little different exposure wise.
Yeah.
But the more, I don't know. On the other hand, I feel like thematically going through the music, I don't, and just reading, you know, interviews with Jason, it seems like being bigger than they were wasn't necessarily the desired outcome.
Yeah. That's kind of where I was going to go next. In the past, we've heard Jason being really frustrated with the music industry, just the relentless touring combined with the multiple hats that we now learn kind of after the fact that he was wearing all at the same time as a songwriter, producer, promoter, spokesperson. He was handling it all, really. And you take all that and couple it with Jason's personality, again, that we kind of know more in hindsight about, and it became just too much to bear. And ultimately, that's kind of what led Granddaddy to dissolving. What from your experiences with your band do you have on this perspective on just the grind of the music industry and how taxing it can be over time?
Oh man, it's funny because I second all of those feelings that, you know, it can be incredibly discouraging. It can definitely feel like a grind and, you know, a little bit different in every way from the expectations that you would have going into it career-wise. The funny thing is, in my experience, as it relates to me being a Granddaddy fan, is I felt like the further I got in my career, the more I understood thematically in the Granddaddy music. Like I didn't really understand when I first fell in love with Jason Lytle's music, I didn't necessarily understand all of the themes, all of the reasons behind what he had to say. And it wasn't really until the kind of drag parts of that life kind of settled in that I realized, like, oh, that's what this song's about. it's that like, it made me appreciate the, you know, kind of the duality of all of it. Like, you can resent a place and miss it at the same time. You can be excited and be terrified, and all of these kind of competing feelings can exist at the same time, and almost always will if your pursuit is, you know, something in the arts that, you know, it's kind of like a high wire act. So I think that I came for the, you know, the cool keyboard tones and the incredible progressions and melodies, and I stuck around for the brutal truths.
So I'm curious, would you consider Jason's music, his songwriting, to be something that you simply enjoy and indulge in, or is it truly an influence in the way that you think about songwriting yourself?
It's hard to say. I feel like a lot of the calls, like a lot of the musical decisions that he makes consistently, that kind of create like a theme and a style in his songwriting, I just find very agreeable. Like, there, it's exactly what I would want to hear. And I think that I probably separate that world from what I, you know, depending on the project that I'm working on at the time, like I try to keep what I would prefer as a listener and a music fan kind of in its own protected world, mm-hmm. from you know, whatever I'm working on at the moment, because the odds are if I'm being completely selfish about something, it's going to kind of go down that road way more than whoever I'm working with wants it to. So I kind of always default to wanting those chords to go in a place that Jason would take them to. You know, kind of wanting production to sound like the balance of, you know, slightly broken but very lush, and like that mid-fi kind of crunchy, sparkly thing that are, you know, the signatures of all these records. Mm-hmm. But I try, and also I'm in a band with a lot of guys that they totally have my number. So it's like, you know, when I throw out a chord change, or like, you know, like a relative major where a typical pop song would go somewhere else, they'll say like, ah, well, he's, you know, he doesn't know how to stop being a Granddaddy fan today, so we're gonna get back to this later.
They literally call you out as Granddaddy fan. Is that what you're saying?
You know, it's just like I don't know. I'm a little bit of a cartoon sometimes. But yeah, I also at the end of the day though, it's hard to fight what you want the most. And I've made some music that I've listened back to it and I've thought like, oh no, this might be a complete ripoff. Like I hope I didn't completely lift this from a Lytle record. But luckily it'll probably never come out, so.
That's funny. In some of the other episodes this season, we've heard a few of the guests describe Jason's approach to music in interesting ways. Ben Bridwell called him a musical savant. Melogian commented on how he tricks the listener into thinking something's lo-fi when it's actually hi-fi. And in the last episode, Kramus referred to this magical hat that Jason pulls shit out of. And my question to you is, do you think Jason's songwriting ability is something that just comes natural? Like either you have it or you don't, or is it something that you can actually develop through, you know, hard work, application, through devotion to that craft?
I think that practice and repetition in any craft can help somebody find their own voice. I think that there is a, you know, like that anybody who's way smarter than me that talks about the process of songwriting, it seems like they always refer back to what the songwriter is trying to express and say, and be how they're trying to be their most honest self. And I think that you can do something long enough and enough times that you are better at being the truest version of yourself. And it's hard to explain, but I feel like when you follow the progression through the Granddaddy studio albums, mm-hmm. into the Lytle solo albums and the other, you know, the Ad-Rad stuff, like the Banquet stuff, like I think that I think that there's like you can find different spaces that you end up comfortable in that maybe you weren't comfortable in before because you are more comfortable with yourself as a writer. But I think the most special moments are when you just kind of say like, no, actually this is exactly how I'm going to do it. And I want it to be exactly the way that I want it. And it's funny, the episode that you did with Ben, when he was kind of talking about the process of working with somebody that knows exactly what they want. Mm-hmm. And has like a very strong sense of the way that things should go. I think that's a place to end up. Like that, you know, that is where I think real artistry ends up inevitably in that realm where you kind of, you know, for better or worse, like you know exactly, you have a vision and you will like work yourself to the bone to kind of get the closest version of that on record.
Yeah, when you mentioned a few minutes ago about progressing through the different studio albums, it made me think about his songwriting and how it evolved over time as well. And not that it necessarily was worse and improved, but just that it was different. I mean, the earlier things, I don't think that a lot of those songs were about him himself. They might have been about emotions that he was feeling at the time. But as you got into those later albums, you could sense themes that were at least implied to be autobiographical. And then, you know, with Last Place that came out just a few years ago, it was in your face, right? I mean, it was just very vulnerable. And I almost felt uncomfortable on a couple of those songs. Like I'm listening to these like incredibly private emotions that he had to be going through on some of those songs, right?
Man, Boat's in the Barn.
Yeah, right.
Like, stab you in the heart. Right. Absolutely. Yeah. It's funny because I kind of felt the same way when I, you know, to like backtrack a little bit, I remember when Family Cat came out. Mm-hmm. And it was a really big deal for us. And when I say us, I mean, you know, my close friend group. And because we, you know, at that point we were all super fans, and we, you know, we couldn't, like, we had devoured Toddzilla, and we couldn't, you know, the whole mythology around it was already like firmly in place that it was, you know, it was done on all of Jason's old gear, like basically, you know, while Family Cat was being finished and mixed, and it came out and blew our minds. It was so good. And we couldn't fathom at all how this record could be secondary to whatever was about to come out. Like that was just too, you know, it was too much. It was too exciting. And, you know, Family Cat obviously is like, so dense, sound wise, theme wise, production, you know, production and like just songwriting wise, like it, mm-hmm. it's dense and it's thick. It's got a lot of layers, and it was like a very heavy meal. And I remember, and I can't remember exactly how we just, you know, like artists got information out to the fans back then. It must have been MySpace, or maybe I read an interview or something. But I remember before Family Cat came out that it had kind of been, you know, it had kind of been announced that that it was going to be the last record and that they weren't going to tour on it. And so it was like, it was a very, very bittersweet type of thing for us when it came out. And then we were all really excited when the first Yours Truly, The Commuter came out or was announced. And it seemed like there was a lightness to it. Like there was a little bit, you know, it wasn't foreign. Like it felt like Jason Lytle, but it felt like there was also a little bit of a weight lifted. You know, there was less pressure. If Family Cat was him feeling pressure to end this legacy on like the highest, most complete note with, you know, with all of the nods and everything. Yeah. It felt like the first solo record was just a little bit less pressure on that he put on himself, and it was amazing. I felt like, you know, you were getting this balance of autobiographical stuff with like some character study stuff, and I don't know, like it really felt like a step forward, even though it wasn't more like bombastic, or it wasn't, you know, it didn't have a million layers.
Yeah, I think those two records you mentioned there are probably my two favorites, like top to bottom. I mean, I think there's some songs that I prefer, obviously based upon the countdown that I did that you were following, but there were some others that I like more that are on different, but just like top to bottom, like Family Cat and Yours Truly, The Commuter, that when those like pop up on my playlist or whatever, it's just like I get excited still. It's just, they're just such great records.
They're so good. They're so good. And I end up with moments from Family Cat stuck in my head probably.
Yeah.
You know, a couple times a day. Whatever is wrong with my head, it just kind of plays the same, you know, 14 songs over and over again. And
yeah.
If it's not Built to Spill, it's usually something off one of these records.
Going back to Toddzilla that you were mentioning, I don't know if you're following the Twitter conversation on some of those songs, but I think during it, Jason mentioned that he like recorded those in like a day or a day and a half or something like that, just while Family Cat was being mixed, like in the room next door, like just so effortless. And I just remember thinking like, how in the hell are you able to, these are gems of songs, right? That EP.
It's so unfair. It's right. So unfair. And no, I like it. That's the right mythology, you know, that's how you should, like, I would imagine if you were functioning at that level, that it would be as you grow and as you progress in your craft, the way that, you know, the way that he had by the time he was making Family Cat, like you would have to put some crazy parameter on yourself, like working on an old rig in a small room next to somebody who's mixing your record, and record a bunch of shit in one day to not have it turn out like Family Cat, you know, like,
yeah,
you would need to force this kind of restraint upon yourself to not spend an entire year on something, you know. It's, and I don't know, that was, that blew my mind, because I had to go back and check just the dates, because I, to make sure I remembered it correctly, that, you know, that they put out Toddzilla before Family Cat, because we couldn't believe, we loved that record so much that we couldn't believe that wasn't the next actual record.
Yeah.
That there was something even more like coming down the pike.
Yeah. I remember I forget, like, he even explained like the reasons to why he did the EP. It was like almost like just to see if he could do it or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
So crazy.
Yeah. It's nuts. But I also, you know, I think that as a fan, you take all of these little things and part of you like files them away for lessons that you could maybe use someday. And I think that whole, like, the fact that he basically did it as an exercise has always been in the back of my mind, that, you know, to think like, oh, you can actually like just trust your instincts and something can turn out great. Like you can labor over something for forever. And, you know, if you have enough vision, like there's a chance that you might not suck all of the magic out of it, but you can also just go in the room next door and knock out whatever the first thing comes to mind. And that's going to be like a boiled down version of what you've got.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Switching gears, I wanted to get your thoughts on the Twitter project. I mentioned in the intro how I had discovered that you were a fan of Jason's just from a comment that you'd made afterwards, but wanted to just get your thoughts on the project overall.
I'm so grateful to the project and to all of the cool versions of songs that you found and compiled. It was really, oh man, I've said a couple times it was a highlight of the pandemic for me. But really the Countdown project, it was something to look forward to, and it was something to get really excited about. And I think it's probably the only thing that I made any attempt to try to turn anybody onto in the last year. Just really like it was really incredible, and it made me really happy. I think one of the one of the cooler I was really proud when you linked to the live Birds Encourage Him that Jason and Aaron did in the airport.
Why just one more night? Why you don't even try?
I forgot all about that, but that was like my best friends shot that.
Yeah. Okay.
And they also did the I Am Lost music video. And so they did, you know, it seemed like at that time they, you know, like their dream of all dreams was to work with Jason on something. And so the fact that you linked that, I completely forgotten about that super weird airport show, and that video is so good.
Yeah, the audio is so great too. I remember I found it on YouTube or something like that, and that's actually one of my favorite versions of that song. It's just so stripped down. It's so great.
It's so good. But really, it was. I don't think anybody. I don't think anybody really could have braced themselves for how much fun and how great it became. And the fact, I Jason's participation, you know, in the whole thing, I felt like there was as much of him put out there into the world through your project as, you know, the world got in, you know, 10 years of interviews. I felt like the insight was just, as a fan, was one of the most incredible gifts.
All right, but before wasting a bunch more time, I don't want to take up too much of your time today. Let's talk about what your favorite song written by Jason Lytle is.
Oh man, so it's hard. It's hard to pick. It is hard to pick. It's hard because it always like it shifts around a lot. But my first, and this is kind of where I feel like I was almost a little bit late to the game as far as being a huge Granddaddy fan goes. And so by the time my first Granddaddy record that I really fell in love with was Someday, I think when I rediscovered the band, and like it was probably 2004, Someday was the most recent record. Mm-hmm. And to me, I think it's perfect. I think that, like, back to front, you know, if I had to make a list of like five perfect records, it would be, you know, number one, two, or three. And it's so good. I think I would probably pick Lost on Your Merry Way. And it really, like, I don't, that there's something about that song, something about how it kind of, you know, it combines all of, like, all of these different competing feelings. The whole record. I mean, I feel like that there's a theme that runs through that entire record, and it's that type of, you know, like the getting the thing that you want, and it's not exactly giving you what you thought it would, and you missing the place that you swore you would never miss, and all of that kind of, I don't like that burned out desert imagery. Like it didn't feel foreign. Like it didn't feel foreign to me. Like it felt, you know, like Modesto could have been any other part of the Southwest, you know. It could have been like boredom is boredom, and like kind of aimlessness is aimlessness. They're like this kind of universal, this universal feeling of not really knowing where you're going, and kind of loving it and also kind of hating it at the same time, is like, I feel like that record does a really great job of painting all of the different shades of that weird, complicated, like, dual feeling. And never know. Wordplay is just like, I mean, I feel like it would be a great single Jason Lytle song to kind of pull apart, just from like the clever, you know, like the very dry, overly clever, you know, like the double entendres are just, they're great, you know. It's kind of, It's a little bit of humor with a little bit of sadness. And it's for me, it's just kind of, it's such a great snapshot of all of the thing, like the essence that I think make his songwriting unique and important. It also, you know, I love the bridge. I love the way that it kind of opens up into this really, you know, into this really dreamy, like, I don't know how to describe, you know, this like pontification, like No, my words are really bad when it comes to this song. I remember that song kind of became like my mantra a little bit. Like, you know, particularly like the second half of that song, that was kind of the thought that was going through my head on a loop, when I was at a point touring, being completely over it and being exhausted, or, you know, kind of like wishing that you were at home. That refrain at the end of that song just kind of became, you know, that was like my, you know, like, this is gonna be fine. Like, you're gonna get, like, this is gonna be over. You're gonna get through this. We'll be right back. like, you know, in a way, like, I fell in love with this song, and it wasn't until years later that I actually felt like I understood the place that that song was coming from. And I'm, you know, I had it when I needed it. And
yeah, I felt like when you were describing that earlier, that you were talking about this song almost, although in reality, it could have been several other songs too, as well. But this song in particular, I agree. I don't think I understood exactly what the song was truly about until we found out kind of more information after the fact, after Granddaddy, years later, and it started to make a lot more sense. And it really felt like it embodied a lot of those emotions that Jason was going through during those times.
Thanks to Drew Brown for his wonderful perspectives on Granddaddy and Jason's songwriting. I hope all of you would agree that despite Drew not having a direct personal connection with Jason like most of our other guests to date, this was still an incredibly worthwhile listen. On the next episode, we'll be heading back overseas for our next guest. It'll be a howling good time, I'm sure of it. Speak to you all very soon. Just